You've heard the stereotypes. Millennials are lazy, they're frivolous, they spend money they don't have. But our next guest makes the case that those stereotypes aren't true and that millennials are the products of a difficult economic time. He says the vast majority of millennials are drowning in debt. They're half as likely as their parents to own a home. One in five live in poverty. Michael Hobbs is a contributing writer at HuffPost Highline. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that those stereotypes were kind of your starting point and what ended up being a deep dive into what's going on with the economy and how it's affecting millennials. But your basic case, it's not the millennials themselves. It's the economy they grew up in.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of what you hear about millennials comes down to individual differences. Things like we're more spoiled, we're more entitled, we're more lazy. But when you talk to researchers, there's really no evidence for that whatsoever, that younger generations have always been looked upon with kind of mystery by older generations. Whereas what has changed and what is measurable, and there's a mountain of economic data on this, is that the country around us has changed a lot. So when my dad was in college, he worked 10 hours a week in the library, and that was enough to pay for his tuition. And when I was in college, I worked around 15 hours a week at a video store, and that was enough for around half of my tuition. And then if you look at the numbers now, with the federal minimum wage at around $7.80 an hour, and even public education costing more than $25,000 a year, if you're working 10 or 15 hours a week, that's less than 10% of what you need to go to college. And so when we focus on individuals, we forget these larger structural factors that are really affecting the way that young people live now.
And you write that the Great Recession isn't the whole story here, but it made things even worse for a chunk of millennials, people who graduated maybe 2008 to 2012. They were, you write, passed over for jobs during the recession and then not picked up later. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there's about 50% of college graduates, people that graduated in 2007, had a job lined up when they graduated. By 2009, that was down to 20%. And so at the height of the recession, there were six applicants for every job. And so a lot of the advice that we were getting was kind of build a personal brand and do your best and this kind of thing. But fundamentally, in the recession, there were just too many people and not enough jobs. So for this story, I interviewed somebody who graduated in 2009 with a degree in economics. And he tried to get jobs as bank tellers, which was the only jobs that he could get interviews for in 2009. And he just couldn't make it work. And eventually he went back to being a waiter, bussing tables. And now he's a bus driver. And so he's still paying off his student loans. But he really has no chance now of getting into any kind of career job or anything that would let him use his degree. And there's millions of people that are in the same situation.
And that's college graduates we're talking about there. Talk about the high school graduates.
Well, I mean, we tend to focus, when we talk about millennials, we often focus on the college grads and how much harder it is for college grads, and that is objectively true. However, two-thirds of millennials did not graduate from college. And when you think about the economy that our parents and our grandparents graduated into out of high school, there were lots of jobs available that were kind of low-skilled jobs, but you were in a union, you were working in manufacturing, you had some sort of steady, decent middle-class job. And now nearly all of those jobs that don't require a college degree are very low paid. They're much less secure. You're a lot more likely to be hired as a kind of like a consultant. You know, they call you a consultant, but really you're there every day, 40 hours a week. And just the quality of jobs has just really degraded. And so for those two-thirds of millennials that don't have college degrees, things have never been harder.
That's a big point you make as far as the changing economy that millennials graduated by high school or college into. The concept of working for an employer who's going to maybe be your full-time career, maybe provide benefits, has been replaced by, in some cases, the gig economy, in some cases by being a temporary worker or working for a contractor for another company. Can you talk about that shift?
Well, what's interesting is we usually think of things like the gig economy, like Uber, as kind of taking over the economy. But right now, that's only about 3% of American workers, whereas people who work under quote-unquote contingent arrangements are around 40% of the workforce now. And that's people that are hired as consultants, and so they're not actually working for the main company. So when you think about a company like Google, they have bus drivers who drive their employees from San Francisco every morning. They have cafeteria workers. They have people who clean their offices. In a previous generation, all of those jobs would have been Google employees. So all of those people would have been on the Google pay scale. They would have been able to get training to get other jobs in Google. There was kind of a ladder of opportunity that would pull them into middle-class jobs from those entry-level positions. And now all of those people are working for contractors. So when you talk to people that work for these kind of contingent arrangements in these companies, there's really no way for them to get into the company proper, like to get into the mothership. There just isn't really a path for that anymore because there's nobody that can say, hey, we have this employee training program, or hey, we have this way that you can apply for an HR position. No one really knows you and no one's really looking at you as an asset or skill. So you're just selling a service. And so this is millions of people in the workforce, and there's just no way for them to get into these companies that will allow them to enter the middle class.
Michael Hobbs is with us. We're talking about the economic challenges facing millennials. Michael, we've talked about the job side. There's more we can get into there. Let's go to the housing side now, though. You write about spiraling housing costs around the country, especially in places where the jobs are.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we've kind of overlooked as a country is the extent to which jobs are concentrating in big cities. So the 100 largest cities in America have added about 6 million jobs since the recession, whereas rural areas in the country still have fewer jobs than they did in 2007. So if you're a young person, you've just graduated from high school, you've just graduated from college, if you want one of those few jobs left that gives you benefits, that pays a decent wage, you really have to move to a city now. You have to move to San Francisco or Boston or Chicago or any of these cities. But the problem with moving to those cities is that housing costs have become so high in those cities that as an entry-level person who's trying to get onto the ladder, all of your costs are taken up by your housing. And so this actually shows up in the data that for workers like this that were moving to high-cost cities in a previous era, their wages were higher and they paid more for housing costs, but their wages were so much higher that it actually made sense for them to do that. Whereas now, the higher housing costs, I mean, think about San Francisco, right? Where a one-bedroom apartment costs $3,000 a month. Even if you're getting a decent paying job, you're making $60,000, $70,000 a year, that sounds like a great salary. But if $3,000 every month is going to your apartment, your only option is to really just really struggle for the first decade of your career or to live, you know, an hour, 2 hours out in the suburbs and have these punishing commutes where it's really difficult for you to kind of enter a career and have enough kind of mental energy to be working as part of your day. And so the housing crisis really can't be separated from the economic structures that we have in the country now, that a lot of people, instead of moving to these big cities where all the jobs are, they're just kind of staying put because they figure, hey, you know, I can't afford to live in San Francisco, so I'll stay in my smaller town. But there aren't as many jobs in smaller towns, and especially there aren't any well-paying, secure jobs in smaller towns. And so these are really the two options that young people face now, and it's a catch-22 for a lot of us.
And you point toward zoning policies in a lot of big cities as part of the problem. The places that have the jobs people are going to want, there's been a long-term bias toward protecting current homeowners and protecting their property values, and that's been preventing any kind of affordable housing from popping up.
Well, what a lot of people don't know is that it's basically illegal to build apartment buildings in the center of large cities. So when you look at the inner ring suburbs of growing, booming cities, places like San Francisco or Seattle, it would make a lot of sense to replace some of these large homes with large backyards with modest 2-3-story apartment complexes or maybe duplexes, or even allowing people to just rent out their basements and have a little bit of extra income. That's literally illegal in a lot of parts of the country, especially in these cities. And a lot of that is because homeowners want to preserve their parking. They want to preserve their neighborhood character. These are things that are understandable. But the fact is, these cities are booming. People are moving to these cities, whether they like it or not. And so when homeowners say, we don't want anything to change in our neighborhood, what they're basically saying is, we want young people and people that are poor to live as far out from possible and have these long commutes and have their lives be as inconvenient as possible because we don't want to lose our parking. And I think that it's understandable that people think that way, but we all need to make sacrifices and we all need to open up opportunities to people to live closer to cities. Cities have better social services, they have better schools, they have better hospitals. And so what basically wealthy homeowners are doing is they're saying, we don't want anyone else to share in those things, so we're going to keep it illegal to build any homes near these great social services.
We're talking to Michael Hobbs. He wrote a piece for Huffington Post Highline on the economic challenges facing millennials. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a millennial? How are you doing? Are you drowning in debt? Are you facing a lot of student loan debt? Are you able to find a job in a place where you can afford to live? Call in at 800-642-1234. And we're going to get into some of the psychology here. Are you feeling anxious about this? Is this weighing on you, on your mind all the time? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up our conversation now about the financial challenges facing millennials today. That's people born between about 1982 and 2004. Our guest is Michael Hobbs. He says millennials have the worst financial luck since the Great Depression. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a millennial, or maybe your kids are millennials? What do you think of the economic landscape they're facing? If you're a millennial yourself, are you stressed about all this? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hey, yeah, so I'm a registered nurse. I've been so for over a year. I'm 23 years old, and I'm working 3 part-time jobs just because full-time jobs are so lucrative because of insurance. And then I'm actually lucky enough right now to have one of my part-time jobs offers insurance, but it's crazy expensive, to the tune of $500 a month. You know, rent's crazy if you want to live somewhere where the roof doesn't leak. All the bills associated with modern living, I'm thinking cell phone, car insurance for a 23-year-old is impossible. I've never been in an accident, but because I'm a young male, they just take my arm and my leg for insurance. But then even working as a nurse's salary, I still feel as though like I'm barely living paycheck to paycheck, especially after taxes. And so then I don't know how people, $7.25 is not a living wage. I'm not even sure $10 is a wage. And then you throw on the price of groceries. If you're trying to eat healthy, it's 4 times more expensive than the processed garbage. And that's how I feel, overwhelmed and dead inside as a millennial trying to make it in this modern society.
Jacob, wow, thanks a lot. Michael, a lot there. You've heard a lot of stories like that. I want to go to his last point there. He feels overwhelmed. He feels dead inside. This is not just an economic story. This is a mental health story almost, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you can't see me, but I'm like violently nodding. I mean, I talk to so many people in the same situation. And what's really interesting about Jacob's situation is that healthcare costs are out of control. The healthcare industry is wildly profitable, and yet it's creating these jobs where somebody has to have 3 part-time jobs with a degree just to make ends meet. And so there's a fundamental breakdown in the economy, that there's a lot of industries that are doing really well, but the people who work in those industries are not doing well. And I think there needs to be a much bigger cultural conversation about this.
Jacob, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Dustin on the line in Eau Claire. Dustin, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I think this really segues well into what was just being said, a mental health issue and also a policy issue. I mean, a lot of us millennials are feeling like, you know, when you turn 18, you get invited to a leadership table and you're able to vote, and you're able to do those things. But I don't see policy going into our favor very well on a grand scale. You know, as mentioned before, we talked about, you know, policy that stops us from developing larger cities, giving people opportunity to live in those areas. And I really feel strongly that more millennials need to get involved with the conversation that we're having about policy and start doing things, you know, at a leadership level that really benefit us.
Dustin, thanks for that call. And Michael, you make that point yourself toward the end of your piece.
I mean, I think the biggest thing to know is that, you know, there's no scenario for fixing what's been done to us that doesn't go through higher youth turnout. And what a lot of people don't know about youth turnout is that we all know that it's lower than the boomers, millennials should vote more, blah, blah, blah. But some states have 70% millennial turnout and some states have 30% millennial turnout. And what that means to me is that it's not youthful disaffection or that young people don't care about politics. It's that it's harder for us to vote. And you see this in the statistics too, that once millennials are registered to vote, we vote just as often as boomers. The problem is getting us registered because we're more likely to move around. And so we need to take back this country, basically. I mean, I watched what was going on with the GOP tax bill the last couple of weeks with a pit in my stomach, like a lot of other millennials. And this is a giveaway to boomers, and it really hurts young people. And what we need to do is we need to be more active. I completely agree.
Thanks for that call, Dustin. Michael, I think a lot of times when people think about their personal financial problems, it's that. It's personal. It's my own individual problem. It's not a collective problem. It's not a society problem. It's not a policy problem. Do you think that keeps people from getting involved in trying to set policy?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which the thumb is on the scale in favor of corporations now. And I don't think we really realize things like classifying your employees as independent contractors when de facto they're employees is actually illegal. And a lot of attorneys general have gone after companies that are doing this too aggressively. A lot of people don't know that wage theft, the thing where your boss makes you come in early to get your uniform on, is also illegal. People don't understand, I think, or it hasn't been told to us that a lot of these ways in which we're being exploited are actually illegal. And if more people knew about them, they'd be really shocked and offended. And so I think we need to push this cultural conversation to people older than us, especially who haven't worked in entry-level positions in a really long time, to get them to understand that it is objectively more difficult for young people now than it has been since the World War II.
Talking to Michael Hobbs about a piece he wrote on millennials and the economy they live in. Back to your calls with Beth on the line in Rosendale. Beth, hi.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to offer an alternative perspective. My husband and I are both millennials, and we're actually really well off. We do live in a rural area, and my husband commutes 45 minutes. I commute about 25 minutes. But, you know, I think I'd talk about the secret to our success is when we went to college, I have a 4-year degree. My husband has a 2-year degree. We focused on paying off our debt before we made any big financial decisions. And so because we don't have any student debt, we drive older cars, we've really been able to do pretty well for ourselves. And, you know, we're pretty comfortable. We're having a baby on the way, and we already have one child as well. So just to say kind of that not everybody's in this situation.
Beth, thanks for the call. Congratulations on all that and the baby coming up. Be careful commuting out of Rosendale. Watch out for the speed traps there. Michael, not everybody's in the same boat here.
I mean, that's important to acknowledge. Not every single millennial is having these problems. But what's interesting is when you look at the inequalities within millennials, what you see is that the defining inequality between millennials who make it and millennials who don't are the millennials that got help from their parents. So there's a huge gap between white millennials and millennials of color, mostly because the average white millennial has about 86 times more intergenerational wealth that they can draw on. So oftentimes when you hear stories, I don't know what Beth's situation is, and I'm happy for her, but oftentimes in stories of kind of millennials who made it, oftentimes you find that the parents helped pay for college, the parents helped them get out of debt, the parents helped them with their medical bills or with their rent the first couple of years that they were out of school. And that's really decisive for kids that don't have student debt coming right out of college. That's an extra $300-$400 a month that they can use to invest in themselves or take on a slightly riskier job that's going to lead to a better career. And so we need to look at these inequalities within millennials, and systematically, millennials of color do not have as much of this intergenerational wealth to draw on, and that can be really decisive.
Beth, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, I want to spend our last few minutes talking about possible solutions. You lay out a lot of problems, and you also in your piece talk about what could be done about them. Can you give us some of your priorities?
Well, this is the only part of the article that is not extremely depressing. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of cities are doing really interesting work. So San Francisco passed a law that's stopping these exploitative scheduling practices. We all know dozens of states have done higher minimum wages. There's lots going on. There's even a big housing plan that was announced this morning in California to build more housing. There's all kinds of things going on at the local level. And what you see is these activist groups forming at the local level that are starting with city councils, they're starting with mayor races, and really putting these issues onto the agenda. So in 9 of the 11 biggest cities in America, renters outnumber owners. And that's becoming a big political constituency, finally. And so you're seeing all of these other movements forming, mostly driven by millennials who are just really tired of these economic circumstances and want to reverse it.
Do you think, we were talking about millennial voting earlier, do you think with those trends you're seeing on the local level that 2018 potentially could be a big year for millennial voter turnout?
Yeah, we saw it in Alabama. We saw it in the UK, where younger people were much more mobilized to vote. I think when we hear a message that we really want, that we that resonates with us, and we're hearing people who are like us that are running for office and who are speaking to our concerns, we show up. And especially, you know, Oregon did automatic voter registration and also has mail-in ballots, and they have really high millennial turnout. So what we need to do is get better and easier voting procedures to make it easier for people that have two jobs to show up and vote. And that's what the political agenda needs to be.
And then you also write about trying to match policies to the working reality, things like, you know, most people aren't getting health insurance, or fewer people get health insurance through work now. Do we need to rethink how health insurance and other benefits, for that matter, follow people from job to job? As we wrap up, do you think there are policy solutions there?
Yeah, well, look, one type of employees is expensive and one type of employees is cheap. And what you see is companies switching from the expensive employees to the cheap employees. And what we need to do is bridge that gap to make sure that every employee gets benefits, whether or not they're an independent contractor, and every person gets a safety net underneath them, even if they lose their job. And that's where we need to go.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Michael Hobbs. He's a contributing writer for HuffPost Highline. He joined us to talk about the financial challenges millennials are facing around the country. We have a link to that piece that Michael wrote. It's over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can keep the conversation going there if you're a millennial, if you have millennials in your family. Love to see their stories there. What is their personal economy like? How are they doing in the job market? Being able to afford houses, that kind of thing. Was the story you were hearing your story or the story of your family? You can let us go. Just check out Michael's piece and share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org.